thank you for joining us. This is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Fisheries Pod. If you are the generous sort, you can be like Ben, Tyler, Janet, Robin, and John, who all support the podcast on Patreon. Through Patreon, you are able to support the show with either a recurring or one-time donation, which helps us pay for various parts of the show. If that isn't your thing, you can also purchase Fisheries Pod shirts, hoodies, stickers, and face masks on our Teespring store if you feel inclined. So check it out. Our guest today is Ellie Visa. Ellie is a third-year master's student at Michigan State University in the Fisheries and Wildlife Department. Her work is focused on developing genomic and computational tools to assess populations within an adaptive management framework. Her thesis work focuses on the use of effective population size estimates and pedigree reconstruction to assess sea lamprey spawning populations. She also works in outreach as a writer and co-host of the science comedy podcast An Everyday Dissection and informal science shows for K-12 students. Welcome to the podcast, Ellie.
Thanks for having me.
It has been over 100 episodes, kind of putting an age to my name, since I had last had a guest talk about sea lamprey and probably lamprey in general. So let's start with the basics. What are lamprey?
Yeah, so in the Great Lakes region, sea lamprey are a pervasive invasive species. They've been around for a while, and there's been a large control and assessment program devoted to keeping their numbers down across the Great Lakes.
So there are native lamprey in the Great Lakes. So why are sea lamprey such an issue in that system?
Yeah, so I would say that the biggest reason is that they are larger. They evolved to prey on fish that are, you know, they fit in the ocean. And when they came into our Great Lakes, their wounds and, they suck the blood from our native fish, and they're significantly larger than native lamprey. And so their wounds cause more damage, and they're more likely to kill our native fish than native lamprey.
So they're literally sucking the life out of the Great Lakes.
Yes, I think that's a good way to put it.
And you mentioned in your first answer that there's a annual effort to control sea lamprey. So how are managers trying to get rid of them?
Yeah, so there are right now there are two main control techniques, and there's a big effort to look at supplemental controls as well. So right now, lamprey are mostly controlled through physical barriers. So that's things like dams or seasonal electric barriers that are designed to keep spawning adults from traveling from the lakes where they were feeding on native fish into streams where they spawn. And the other control technique is TFM, which is a lampricide that is spread in streams to kill larval lamprey before they metamorphosize and go into the lakes.
One thing I guess never dawned on me before, these are sea lamprey, but they are able to completely live in fresh water. They don't need any sort of salt water to complete a life cycle.
They do not. They complete their entire life cycle in the Great Lakes.
We've discussed how they're trying to get rid of them with electric barriers and lampricides, but how have managers traditionally assessed those efforts to see if they're working, if they're effective at controlling sea lamprey?
So there's three different current techniques that are used every single year to evaluate the success of control programs. So, and those all have to do with those life cycles, the parts of the life cycle that I was just talking about with control. So there's a larval control technique, there's larval assessment. Every year there's a backpack electrofishing efforts that go into a large number of streams to try to catch larvae that are sitting in the substrate. At the juvenile stage, there is a wound marking program. So you're looking at native fish and trying to find those sea lamprey wounds and trying to figure out how many fish in our lakes have wounds this year and what those wounds look like. And then there's also adult assessment, which uses traps and takes place in a small number of streams every year. And they trap and they do a mark recapture assessment to try to get an idea of how many sea lamprey are going up into streams to spawn.
So that's traditionally how they assess to see if their control methods are working. But your master's work is looking at it a little differently. Before we get into the how, let's first learn, I guess, what are genomic and computational tools and how are they used in a fisheries sense?
Genetics has been around, you know, for about a century now, but it wasn't until recently that we were able to sequence large amounts of genetic material to the point where we can do the kind of population genetics that I'm doing today. So population genetics as a field has been around, again, for a long time, and there's a rich history of starting to look at populations using genetics. But the cost of sequencing has gone down significantly in the last 20 years. So we can go from sequencing a few markers to start to get an idea of what these populations look like, to being able to sequence, you know, genomic scale data sets to get you can get really different information with a larger number of individuals and also a larger number of genetic material for each of those individuals. So for example, for my project, we sequenced over 3,000 larval lamprey across 20 different locations. And we were able to do that. We don't sequence the whole genome. We just sequence parts of it that will help us differentiate individuals for what we want to do. And we're able to do that at thousands and thousands of markers for a pretty low cost.
So when you're gathering genetic information, like you mentioned that you're using larval lamprey, do you use the whole lamprey or do you just use part of it? Or I guess, how do you go about collecting your genetic information?
So we used sampling from annual larval assessments. They euthanized the lamprey and ethanol and sent them to our lab. And when we extract DNA from an individual, we don't need the whole lamprey. You just need a really, really small piece. I have found that for most, you know, average size larval lamprey, I usually just take the mouth. And that seems to give me like a pretty consistent amount of DNA to work with.
And so then how are you using the genetic and genomic methods to assess sea lamprey? How is this helping with the control assessment?
Yeah, so the current assessment techniques give us, you know, a look at what's going on with lamprey in streams and in lakes. And mark recapture is done in a small number of streams to start getting at, you know, the number of lamprey that are spawning. But what genomic estimates can tell us are the actual number of successfully spawning adults. So not just how many got up into the stream, but how many parents do we have contributing to the larvae that are found in the streams. And so that's one of the big metrics that we're looking at. We're also looking at things like effective breeding size, which is a population metric that, while not correlated with census size, we can still make inferences about what our spawning populations look like based on that number. So the way that I'm calculating most of these metrics is with a reconstructed pedigree. So in order to assess adults, we sequence the offspring, and then we can reconstruct what their parent genotypes were.
From the genetic information from the larvae, you're able to tell, basically assign some sort of value to each of their parents, and then you can tell if their parents also produced other offspring?
Yeah, so what we're doing is we're connecting families. So we have, you know, lamprey in a jar, and you can't tell just by looking at them, you know, which ones are siblings and which ones aren't siblings. But we can do that with genetic data. And then you can take things like how many of these are siblings or are most of them unrelated? And you can use that information to make inferences about what's going on with the adults.
Sea lamprey have been in the Great Lakes for a little while now. Have you been able to find like multiple generations of lamprey, or do you basically just determine how many parents are out there?
Yeah, so I would say that sea lamprey are kind of an interesting fish in that they spawn once and die. And they're far from the only fish that does that. But what that lets us do is use parentage as a metric for age as well. So if larvae are siblings with each other, not only were they produced by the same parents, but they had to be reproduced on the same year. So we can use that combined with some length data to start to look at how many cohorts we have.
I guess I didn't know my lamprey biology. I didn't know that they died after they spawned. So should have done more research on lamprey.
That's all good.
So I guess, am I missing anything from your master's work? Any main takeaways that you'd like to discuss?
Honestly, I'm kind of at this weird point where I am just finishing up my data analysis and writing up my thesis. I defend in a few months. So there's just kind of this whirlwind of like results and discussion in my brain right now, because that's what I'm trying to outline in my chapters. But what I think is cool about genetic assessment is that it's kind of this, it's another tool in the toolbox, you know? So you have these traditional methods that give you a group of information about sea lamprey, and then you have genetic estimates, and it's sort of like a Venn diagram of information that you can get. So you can get at some of the same things as traditional assessment techniques, but you can also find this other group of information. So I think it's really cool. And I did some modeling in addition to this, where we were looking at whether or not our mercury capture estimates correlated with our NB, our effective size, or our minimum number of spawner estimates, to see if we could sort of use them as a comparative metric, or actually be able to use them in conjunction with each other for assessment. And I finished those models a few weeks ago, and they're not correlated at all. So we can't use them for that. But there's still, like I said, there's that Venn diagram of assessment that we can use.
Looking into the crystal ball of sea lamprey management, and say a manager wants to start using this genetic approach to assess their control efforts, I guess, how expensive is this compared to a trapping and marker capture and all the different field outings compared to that? And how possible is it for managers to do this on their own without having a graduate student do all the lab work for them?
Yeah, so my work is actually a preliminary study. And now that we were, you know, able to get some good estimates there, there's a large 12-year project called SUPCON, where we're going to be, not we, but my lab is going to be a part of this. We're going to be using genetic estimates to assess new control techniques, like sterile male release techniques, or different types of trapping. And so there's a lot on the horizon, and we're going to be using genetic assessment for a lot of it. So it's not just cost to me. So genetic assessment, like I said, has gotten significantly cheaper. I don't know how expensive mark recapture is. I don't have the annual cost of that. But we went from, you know, it being almost $1 million to sequence the first human genome, where as compared to me, I was able to get my genomic sequences for about 400 individuals. It costs about $1,000. So the cost is decreased, and will continue to do so as researchers innovate new genomic techniques that might, you know, continue to make the sequencing process cheaper. But I would say more than that, genetic assessment is done in a different way from current assessment techniques. So we're using, you know, larval assessment data that we already have. So when it comes to sampling effort, we're kind of piggybacking off of the larval assessment techniques. And then we're able to do that in more systems than we're able to do mark recapture. Because mark recapture, while it's, you know, it's a great technique for figuring out how many adult lamprey are in streams, it is difficult and it takes a lot of sampling effort compared to larval assessment. So we have larval data for a larger number of streams than we have adult assessment data. But like I said, I feel like genetic assessment, I wouldn't say that it is better. I would say that it is different. And I think that you can use them in conjunction with each other to get a really good look at our lamprey systems.
And so you mentioned in one of your earlier answers that you looked at roughly 3,000 larval sea lamprey over 20 different streams, I believe. I guess, did you look at samples at all to see if there is kind of a minimum number of larval sea lamprey that you would need to sample in a stream to detect how many adult sea lamprey were out there? Or was there like a cap of how efficient it was?
Yeah, so not only did I do 20 streams, I also did a simulation study to try to figure out the limits of our samples. So I have finite estimates for 20 streams, and we have effective breeding size ranging from lower than 10 to over 1,000. And so that's not the true number of parents, but it's the effective population size. They're a little bit different, and just like a quick reminder of that. But with our simulation study, we wanted to look at, you know, what if NB is 10,000, and you know, what if we're only able to get like 25 larvae, or what if we have 200 larvae? You know, what does that mean? And then we also looked at our end of things, the genomic end of things. So if we have 100 markers versus 1,000 markers, you know, how does that change things? And what we were able to find is that, of course, the more lamprey there are, the harder it is because you've got a bigger population. I think that's true of any assessment technique, is that it is easiest when populations are small, and genetic assessment is no different. But what we were able to find is that even when populations were large, if you have a larger number of markers and sample as many larvae as you can, you have a much better chance at still getting a decent genetic estimate.
So far, it sounds like a lot of your project involved lab work and doing a bunch of number crunching on a computer. Were you able to get out and collect some of the larval lamprey that you used to collect your samples, or were they donated from managers?
So I got to go out to one location. Unfortunately, a lot of my project, I was, you know, in the lab and I was in the computer, which, I mean, they're things that I love to do. But I haven't done a lot of field work. So major props to everyone who helped me collect samples, because, oh my gosh, am I not good at sea lamprey larval assessment. I was out there for 3 days with the backpack electrofishers, with some managers from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And I was trying my best, but it's a backpack and you've got these little, it's really small nets. So you do a low level electricity, you walk up in the stream and you're staring into the water looking for little larvae to come shooting out of the substrate. And then you shock them and try to catch them in the nets before they float downstream. So the field work is crazy. It's awesome. But yeah, I caught like 5 of them and I was so proud of myself. And then, one of the managers came back and he's like, well, I think I have about 100. You ready to go? So it's definitely field work that it takes some finesse, and there are some people out there who are incredible at it. I am not one of those people. But the field work for larval assessment is pretty intense.
You've mentioned in some of your answers that you're kind of wrapping up some of your work and getting some papers prepared. So I'm assuming you're almost finished with your work there. What's next for Ellie after her master's degree?
I am moving to Nova Scotia in June. I'm going to be working on halibut conservation up there. I'm going to be doing still genetic assessment, but I'm going to be looking at census size of halibut populations on the Nova Scotian shelf using close kin mark recapture. So instead of using traps for mark recapture, we use genotypes to capture individuals. And then kind of a similar process where we have both parents and offspring, just like the lamprey, but, you know, halibut reproduce annually and for several years. So we kind of get to double dip with mark recapture, where you have the offspring genotype and their parents. And then you can look for those in all of your genotypes and start to build this like web of population for an assessment technique that way.
So I'm picking up that you like genetics. Which came first? Were you a genetics person who happened to work with fish, or were you a fish person that happened to work with genetics?
Definitely a genetics person landed in fisheries, because I found, you know, a great lab at Michigan State and discovered that I really enjoyed population genetics, and they work in sturgeon. And I was one of the first lamprey projects, I think, in the lab. And they work all across taxa as well, but they have a 20-year long sturgeon project in the lab, and they're doing a lot of environmental DNA work as well.
What drew you to genetics of all the different science fields? What drew you to genetics?
Well, honestly, again, that was also an accident. I bounced around majors quite a bit in college trying to figure out what I was really passionate about. I changed my major, I think, 5 times. I started in nuclear physics. And nothing ever felt quite right to me. And what I love about genetics is that it's this crossroad of very applied science. And this is particularly true, I think, in fisheries and wildlife. You know, the work that I have has direct management applications. I know where it's going. I really like that aspect of working in fisheries and wildlife. And I love math. And so I wanted science that was mathy, where I was able to, you know, learn how to code and do statistics. And I get to do all of that here too. I'm also just interested in genetics as a field. I find it absolutely fascinating. Just being able to look at genomes. I'm such a nerd for sure for everything that I do. And so I love being able to dig into the literature and learn about, you know, what makes living things, living things. I mean, that's ultimately what I'm studying is the blueprint for life. And I just think that that's incredible that we're able to do that.
So we mentioned in the bio that you're the co-host of a science comedy podcast in Everyday Dissection. And I'm sure all of your bouncing around in undergrad between different majors and all the different classes you might have taken might have helped you gain a pretty diverse background in basic general science classes, and at least a little bit of knowledge in every single thing. So what kind of episodes or what kind of topics are you covering in Everyday Dissection?
Yeah, so in Everyday Dissection for us, you know, all science is definitely fair game. I think a lot of our episodes end up having kind of a biology tilt because I'm the scientist on the podcast. My co-host Nick Lemmer is a actor and a comedian, and we met doing community theater like probably 10 years ago now. And so together we try to find science topics that we both think are interesting. And we try to find something that's either literally an everyday thing that, you know, you see all the time. And when we dig in and start to research, you find something that's really crazy about it, or the complete opposite. It's, you know, a science topic or a thing in science that, you know, we'd barely heard of before, and diving into the discovery of that. So for us, we're trying to look at the intersection of science and kind of those science facts and discoveries along with the people that go with it. So whoever discovered it or some kind of history that goes with the science topic, to kind of bring those two together. So we're able to talk about science and tell a story.
The title is An Everyday Dissection. Do you do daily episodes?
God, no. We have an episode every other week. Each outline takes me about 10 hours to put together. I do a lot of research on each topic because I want to feel like I understand it well enough that I can, you know, explain it to somebody else and make jokes about it. And I think that takes like a certain level of understanding to be able to do that. So I definitely couldn't do it every day. I think every other week is about perfect.
All the research required to do that type of show definitely would take a lot of time. I know even just this interview type episode, if I had guests lined up for an everyday, it would take a lot of time to get all that. Just doing the episode and then the editing, just that takes a lot of time without having to do the research. So you definitely need a team to do an everyday podcast.
Absolutely. And it's so the podcast is just Nick and I. So I do the pre-show research and Nick does all of the editing. So we split the work up that way.
So the show is called An Everyday Dissection. Where can people find it?
Pretty much wherever you can get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon, several other places. And our host is Anchor. So you can find us at anchor.fm/an everyday dissection. And we're on Twitter as well, at edissect.
And just to give people a taste, what was your last episode? And I guess, what is your next episode about as well?
Yeah, so we just had an episode come out a few days ago on Lamarckian evolution. So we were talking about the theories of evolution in the 19th century. So that kind of Darwin versus Lamarck thing. And then we talked about the legacy of Lamarckian evolution. It's what I guess kind of a cool thing about Lamarckian evolution is a debunked evolution theory that lived in the Soviet Union through the 1970s and to devastating harm. And so we took some time to talk about that history. And we talked about, use that as a segue to get into a kind of cutting edge, cool new evolutionary topic called epigenetics. So we kind of take you through, it's a mixture of history on evolution, and in there is woven, you know, both Darwinian evolution and Lamarckian evolution theory, and a little intro to epigenetics. And our next episode is going to be, we're going into genetics and we're talking about the discovery of DNA. Specifically, we're talking about Watson and Crick and Rosalind Franklin. It's a particular soapbox issue for me. I feel very passionately about the history of the discovery of DNA. So we're going to talk about that. That'll be out in a few weeks.
My general biology class in undergrad, we had to read a book. The professor let us choose from three or four different titles, and I chose, I forgot what the exact title was, but it was about Rosalind Franklin. I think it might have been called The Dark Lady of DNA. But yeah, I skimmed through it. I was a freshman, so I didn't read it. But I skimmed through it and read some Cliff Note versions on the internet and basically determined that the other guys were crooks and she was the real discoverer.
Yeah,
I'll cut that out if it spoiled anything.
Oh, it is well documented. That's what we're talking about. Definitely part of this episode is going to be dunking on Watson and Crick a little bit for scooping Rosalind Franklin. And we're also going to talk about, you know, their scientific careers after the Nobel Prize, because I think it's really important to talk about that too.
It sounds like you are bringing your kind of love for genetics into the episodes. Have you brought any fish knowledge into any of your episodes of Everyday Dissection?
Absolutely. We have an episode on invasive species that heavily features sea lamprey and other aquatic invasive species. And we also have an episode on conservation that talks about some fish as well.
And your other outreach that you did was informal science shows to K-12 students. I guess, how did you get involved with school-age kids?
So there is a wonderful student organization at Michigan State University called Science Theater. And it's exactly what it sounds like. Is we've got, you know, those big flashy science demos, everything from, you know, a Tesla coil to Bernoulli's, where we're making things fly, lighting all kinds of things on fire. And we bring that into classrooms and auditoriums to show kids that science can be fun. And kind of give them that big flashy thing paired with an explanation for how it happened. And so I was a member there for 4 years and I led the organization for two of those. So I've seen probably done over 200 shows and seen thousands and thousands of kids to, you know, bring these demos to them. And it was really, really an incredible experience. Definitely formative for me. In my outreach journey now.
And so a couple of your answers so far on this podcast have included some sort of tie back to a stage experience you've had. I guess, how has your experience on the stage helped with your science outreach?
I have been acting since I was a little kid. I think it's helped me in a lot of ways. I think the biggest thing for me is just that general comfort with being in front of an audience and knowing that there's going to be a lot of curveballs thrown your way and you kind of have to figure it out. And I think that applies to everything in academia, you know, from meetings to conferences, you know, you always get that question that you weren't expecting. And so I feel like theater gave me a lot of practice of thinking on my feet, and I think it helped me. I had definitely had a lot of stage fright as a kid. So I'm really happy that I got that comfort, you know, throughout my time on stage. And I also think that honestly, the framework of how you build a show and how you build a scientific research project are not that different. They both feel like you're, you know, building a house and solving a puzzle. But you have completely different pieces.
Well, Ellie, I wish you the best of luck as the curtains close on your thesis work and your new adventure in Nova Scotia. But now the tough part of the interview is over, as we are down to the final five questions. And this is a group of five questions I ask each of the guests that come on the show. And we always start real simple with, what is your favorite fish?
This is going to sound really basic, but I feel like sea lamprey are my favorite fish at this point. I've spent so much time with them. I feel like I'd be betraying them if I said anything but that.
That might be one you don't want to betray.
Right?
What is your favorite memory from your career so far?
That's really hard. I think to me, a moment that sticks out is the day I figured out my first data analysis and I got to make my first repository. I was actually up doing field work and I took a break to get some code from somebody else and it was finally done. And it was like, everything just clicked into place. And this was my undergrad project. So it was like my first project. And I finally got to see, you know, the answer and what was going to go in the paper for the first time. And it was just like, I don't know, there's this incredible feeling of like, I just solved a big giant puzzle. And right now I'm the only one that knows the answer to this. And I feel like that's the feeling that I just chase all the time now with my current analyses.
I meant to ask, and when you first brought up Nova Scotia that in your work up there, but is that going to be a full-time job or is it a PhD position?
It's a PhD position. So I'm going to be up there for, I think, 4 to 5 years is the plan.
All right. So then our third question is, once you're finished with your PhD work in Nova Scotia, what is your dream job or dream location that you're hoping to work in?
Ooh, I'm not super picky about the location, but I really want to have a job where it is part research and part outreach. So I can have, you know, a research program, and it would be so cool to, you know, be able to mentor students and work at a university, or, you know, an industry where I can still do research. And then still have that outreach piece where I can go interact with people outside the scientific community entirely, students, you know, other scientists, but, you know, scientists that study things that are super different from what I study, and be able to have both of those aspects in my job.
And is that going to be a fish genetic position or just any environmental genetics?
Well, right now, most of my work is in fish, so I feel like I'm probably going to end up staying in fish, but you never know. And a lot of geneticists end up, even if they're primarily in fish, expanding into other taxa over their careers.
Our fourth question, if money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
I've always been interested in community genetics. So instead of just looking at the genetics of one population, looking at the genetics of a bunch of different species in the same environment, and trying to figure out how they interact with each other and how the environment interacts with them and their genetics.
And finally, if there is one point or one principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
I think for me, the biggest thing that informs just my philosophy in general is I don't think about, you know, my ethics or my research in terms of what's going to happen in the next 1 to 2 years. I think of what's going to happen in the next 100 years, what's going to happen in the next 1,000 years, and how can I orient my life so that I can do the most good on that time frame? How can I use the skills that I have to do the maximum amount of good in the world that I can? And I think if everyone tried to do that, do the maximum amount of good, and we all work together way better than we do now, then I feel like we could solve a lot of problems that we just can't seem to figure out.
Ellie, thank you for coming on the podcast today. It was a pleasure hearing about you and your and all of your work with Sea Lamprey Genetics and in the Everyday Dissection podcast. If people want to find out more information or get a hold of you, what would be the best way to do that?
I am on Twitter at Allele Ellie. So it is the word allele, A-L-L-E-L-L, and then my name, but you squish them together. You can also find my podcast at eDissect or on Anchor at anchor.fm/an everyday dissection. So those are probably the two easiest ways to find me. You can also find me on our department website if you want my email.
And if you would like to get a hold of me, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at fisheriespod or old-fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget, you can help support the podcast with a monthly or one-time contribution through Patreon or by rocking some awesome Fisheries Podcast logo shirts, hoodies, stickers, or face masks available on Teespring. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 120th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, do the maximum amount of good.